Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actress Maggie Siff. At the age most actors have been working for a decade, Maggie Siff was just entering grad school. She was a serious theater actor, more obsessed with improving her craft than TV stardom. But when she got the chance to audition for the role of Rachel Katz in a little six-month art project called Mad Men, she knew the role she wanted would be hers, even though it wasn't the one she was asked to read for. What followed wasn't expected. Roles on hit shows like Sons of Anarchy and Billions were never what she imagined for her career, but they've put her in an enviable position. She can choose projects that challenge her as an artist and reflect her love of complex female characters. No eyebrow tweezing or fake boobs required. So join us for some talk therapy. You'll hear how she prepared to play a shrink to the big boys and what it's like to hang around a set after you're dead. We also discuss her new film, A Woman, A Part. Maggie told me why she worried about doing it and how it forced her to consider the artistic path not taken. So pull up a chair or a couch and listen in. Hi, Maggie.
Hello.
So thanks for doing this.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So it just occurred to me as I was sort of looking through your whole career that you've done these really dramatic roles for really adult shows. You know what I mean? like when I think of Mad Men and Sons of Anarchy and Billions, there's this through line of tragic, adult-themed.
Right.
You know, and I just wonder, like, do you ever just want to go do some stupid comedy? Get naked with Seth Rogen?
No, I would love to. I mean, it's funny, like, you start in on your career and, like, certain things take off or pick up steam and you become associated with that thing, and that's
right.
How people start to think of you. And, you know, I also have worked on projects that I've really admired, you know. I don't think of myself as like a fluff queen in my heart and soul, but I do love comedy, and I think I have comedic ability.
Right.
It just hasn't been the thing that's kind of landed, or the direction that my career has taken, or the shape that it's taken.
Well, I went through and looked at some old roles, and I was like, oh, she was in Funny People. I'll check out that scene, because
right.
I love that film, but I forgot it a long time ago. Turns out, in Funny People, you're a woman without a sense of humor.
I am the woman without a sense of humor.
Yeah.
It's so funny that should be the first thing we talk about. That was such a weird experience for me, because I showed up.
And that was pre-Mad Men, right?
It was right as Mad Men was airing. So
okay.
It was kind of the beginning of my film and television career. Basically been in L.A. about 6 months. But nobody told me that Judd Apatow throws out the script and that it's all improvisational. And so I'm kind of picking up on that as I arrive on set, and then everybody else who's there that day is a genius comedian.
Right.
For whom, like, that's their whole, they live for that, you know? Whereas I was like, I really like having a script.
Yeah.
I really like having some structure. I mean, it was an amazing day to be there, but I think I've never been more intimidated than I was.
Oh, is that true?
That day. I mean, comedians generally sort of scare the shit out of me. Like, I think what they do is scarier than anything I could possibly think of. Sort of like using yourself as material, flying without a net, trying to get laughs and get that kind of immediate affirmation for what you do. Like, one of the nice things about not doing comedy is that you're just looking for truth. You know, you're just,
right.
I mean, and I think comedians are too. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I think that, and the really brilliant ones are sort of trolling for truth and laughs at the same time. But I have an incredible admiration for comedians, but also like a terror of being in their position. And, you know, it's like those are people who spend a lifetime thinking in that way, where everything that's happening in a moment is material for the construction of a joke or a laugh or a payoff or a throwback or a connection. And
did you ever do any improv as training or?
Not really. I mean, I went to a training program, a really wonderful one, where I went to NYU.
And is improv part of that?
I mean, there's certainly enough. There's sort of clowning and games and lots of things where you're trying to hone those skills. But I never did like UCB or any of those improv
right.
classes, sort of more intensive trainings in that way, where, you know, there are a lot of actors who sort of come up that way. And that wasn't really the way that I sort of came into being. But in my training program, they did encourage your ability to fly without a net, because that is part of even working within a script, obviously, is sort of finding the liberation in moments and in beats and, you know, places for flights of imagination and creativity.
Do you ever think about what the roles you take and the roles you're offered, what it says about you?
Yeah, no, I mean, after Mad Men, I mean, that role in Funny People, she was a character whose name was Rachel.
And, oh, really?
And they met on, they end up having a conversation about J-Date, so she's
right.
A Jew.
Well, there's a great joke in there.
No, it is. And actually, you know, I will say, like, I realized once I got there on that day, I was like, my job is not to be funny. My job is to be the straight man here and to sort of throw the whole scene into relief. And I was totally happy to do that and relieved in a way that I wasn't having to sort of compete with the comedians.
Oh, I'd much rather
as
be
a straight
comedian. Man. In any situation, especially with Adam Sandler.
Yeah, I know. I got just to watch him, you know, sort of stone-faced do his thing, which was a really pleasurable thing to do. But when I first got out here and I did that role on Mad Men, like, I was called in for every Jewish part you could imagine, explicitly Jewish part. And, you know, and it took a while, probably took Sons of Anarchy to kind of break that lane open.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. The joke that I would always make is like, well, there are worse ways to be typecast because they tend to be smart. You know, like the roles were always sort of smart and sharp and, you know.
Right, you're not, you don't have heroin needles sticking out of your arms.
No heroin needles, no fake boobs. I don't know, you know, things to be grateful for in this town when you're a woman.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. But, you know, it is funny to think about that because, you know, on Billions, you obviously play an extremely smart person. Mm. And you know that, you know, in this case, she's a therapist and she's sort of holds a mirror up to these very powerful men. And mm-hmm. Did you sort of want to research that profession?
Well, the first person that Brian and Dave referenced when they were talking about the character, Brian and Dave, the creators of the show, was Tony Robbins. So the very first thing I did was I went to his TED Talk, where he gives this amazing TED Talk about the work that he's done in the world and how he works with people. And one of the things that happens in that TED Talk is he addresses the audience and he says something like, have any of you here ever done something where you failed and then you're really mad at somebody else? And Al Gore's in the audience and he goes, the Supreme Court. And he has this laser focus on Al Gore and he says, the Supreme Court. And he proceeds to kind of dress him down in this way. It's like, yes, it was, the Supreme Court did make a decision, but it was actually your fault too.
Really?
Yeah. Like, within 2 minutes, he has this exchange with Al Gore where he kind of, like, takes him apart but does it really kind of beautifully, really swiftly, really artfully.
And like, you can't not respect Tony Robbins after you watch that.
You kind of can't not respect Tony Robbins after you watch that. It was really interesting. But one of the things that they were interested in and why they referenced Tony was they were interested in this idea of a therapist who isn't going the traditional route, but who's interested in who's not passive, who's not just letting somebody tell their story for months and years on end, hoping that they will arrive at
they want a quick transformation.
Yeah, they're interested in somebody who, a character who has the power to help people transform quickly and sort of get out of their own way. And part of that is sort of the profit motive, and you know, performing in these incredibly high-stakes situations. So I studied Tony Robbins. I had a phone chat with him because one of the guys knows him, and I got to talk to him. And then I met with a couple of other people who do things that kind of resemble what the character does in the world.
Right.
So I kind of, like, attacked it from all these different angles and reading and talking to people, and then we have really great writers, so.
You know, when I think of writing and the relationship to a script, yes, a writer writes dialogue and it's your job to embody it, but I think it's in the embodiment that there's so many choices and so many decisions that bring it to life three-dimensionally. And then when I started to think about your part, I wondered, like, do you as an actor think about body language and especially, I mean, let's face it, a lot of your scenes, especially in the first season,
you are sitting across from somebody, mm-hmm. right? So it's not like you get a lot of active motion around the room.
Right.
Like, do you think about that? Do you think about how to use your body in ways to...
One of the things I quite like about the role is how much sitting in a chair I get to do because...
Because people don't know this, but you can't walk.
No, I can't walk. I mean, it's a particular kind of constraint, and I find that usually any kind of constraint as an actor ends up being helpful. So, you know, there's how you sit and everything else, but just planting, just like having to plant and listen and be as present as you can possibly be, which is the job of a therapist,
yeah.
is actually really satisfying as an actor, to just like be still and take somebody in as fully and as wholly as you can, and then be targeted about how you challenge a person. It's like very surgical, you know, what she's doing. And so I do think about, you know, obviously that kind of body language, but for the most part, I find that the character wants to just be still and be as precise as she can with the person she's dealing with in the moment. And that's, it's a great challenge, but it's also really pleasurable.
That says it all about your ability as an actor too, because I would think that much like you describe the terror of being around a bunch of comedians and that blank page feeling of anything's possible. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of actors would be afraid if so many of their tools were taken away and they just have to sit still.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think that's really interesting that you find that comforting and not limiting.
I think it's one of the... Like, I started out in the theater, and on stage I think of myself as a very physical performer. So I think about the body a lot in what it is in front of a camera versus what it is on a stage. And I think because on stage you're filling space, you know, and the frame is always what it is.
Right.
And the audience is always on, has you, but always has the whole frame in front of them. It's kind of, you know, the body becomes an incredible tool for how you fill that canvas. Whereas on camera, you know, you're in front of the lens, and the lens is so powerful and magnifying that doing less and less and less can sometimes, not always, but can sometimes be like a very powerful tool.
Right.
And I think a lot about how, you know, certain actors on camera are very kinetic and are very physical, and I think certain roles also really call for that.
Yeah.
But certain actors need that. Like Paul Giamatti is actually a very, he's a very kinetic performer. He has a lot of control over his body and how he uses it, but he kind of needs to get to move his body for things to sort of move, circulate through
right.
him. And he does it in really interesting ways. And I love watching him because I also really admire people on camera who can be sort of really, really physical without distracting or detracting from what
like you say, someone who has control over their physicality
yeah.
though, so they're not all over the place. But
yeah.
would you say that your own style leans more towards the precise or towards coming in with an intention on how to do it? Or are you someone that can sort of like try a bunch of stuff and throw it away? And
television is so specific in terms of process, like because time is so crunched and you don't really rehearse. So, you know, like when I sit at home, what I do is I try to just delve and delve and delve into the language and the meaning of the words that I'm saying as much as I can, so my intentions are as specific and explicit as they can be. I don't think about how I'm going to move or, you know, sometimes I'll get up on my feet to feel it in my body. But because I know the character and I know the characters with whom I'm speaking, I kind of know that'll be there for me.
Right.
So I just try to get as precise as I can with my intention and with my understanding of exactly what I'm saying, why I'm saying it.
Is there a threshold you have to pass where it passes a test for you that it's authentic, that you understand the words? And
I think so. Making it your own, it sounds so plain, but memorizing the shit out of it. So the language is effortless. So you're not looking. Sometimes to me, it feels like when I'm looking for the language on the day, I've failed.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think sometimes that can yield fruit, and for some people, it's very helpful. But for me, it needs to be more deep in for it to feel like I can have a totally successful day
right.
on set. And then I just try to let things happen. You know, like I try different physicality and we play with blocking and, you know, so I would say where I'm kind of oriented is just really around the language and the intention of the language. And then I try to be as free as I can in my body and in all, you know, in everything else. And
right.
When you come from the theater, that desire to like rehearse and do more and try again and try something else. And like my appetite for that is kind of bottomless. So if a director says, do you want another take? I always say yes.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh yeah, sure. Do we have time? I'll take that. You know, like I'll just keep going because I always feel like there's more refinement and there's, you know, it can always go deeper. It can always go further. It can always be more interesting. And, you know, there's just not that time.
Was that something hard coming from the theater and getting your education in TV about how little you got to actually act?
Yeah, it was weird. I mean, it is weird. But I've been lucky to work with great actors, you know, many of whom have, you know, showed me things along the way that were helpful. And, you know, I feel like my training also prepared me for knowing how to work on my own and knowing how to work at home.
Right.
And then there's also something very exciting about just needing to go in and do it and throw it against the wall and then let it go. Like, the great thing about working on film in film and television is that, like, if you have a really difficult, cathartic or emotional or painful thing to do, you do it and it's done.
Right.
You know, whereas in the
theater,
you have
to come back the next night doing
it. You have to relive it every night. And that can really take a toll.
Yeah, I bet. Going back to the whole therapy thing, because
yes.
I think that there's something powerfully calm about your presence. And I always think of therapy as the good therapist hold up a mirror to you.
Mm-hmm.
They have this ability to always turn it back around. And the times I've done therapy, I think part of me is sitting in the chair thinking about whatever problem I have. And the other part is thinking if I could just get the key or the architecture to what the therapist is doing, then I don't need to come here and do it. You know what I mean? And I wonder if, you know, if the times you've done therapy in your life or if you've done it while you've had this role,
mm-hmm.
if you have sort of an eye on that process for them.
It's funny because the therapist who I feel has helped me the most in my life is like couldn't be a more different therapist than Wendy Rhodes.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, to the extent that what has been the most powerful for me in therapy is really just sitting across from another person who has warm, non-judgmental regard for your experience. And somebody who has helped me figure out how to not be so harsh with myself, you know, who made me aware of how deeply and powerfully judgmental of myself I was. And her tool for doing that, I think, I don't know, because I don't know what the key is, but I believe now, looking back on it, that her tool for doing that was really just positive, warm, non-judgmental presence and regard, and gently calling my attention to those places and those ways in which I was hurting myself, downgrading myself, or judging myself.
Right.
And I think Wendy does that. I mean, I think she has positive, warm regard for the people who are sitting across from her and presence. You know, I believe that quality of attention is the most powerful thing. I actually do believe that in therapy, the most powerful thing is somebody who is just paying deep and very close attention. And sitting in that regard is what creates transformation.
Right. Although, obviously, in the case of your therapist, that's a long, long, long process.
It's perhaps a longer process.
Yeah. But I hear that about that being powerful because it's very rare that we get to be in that situation in life. And if someone has the power
mm-hmm.
to not interject their own issues into a conversation,
that's right.
They almost become like a sage.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so curious, like, because I deal with the same things. I think that I've gone through life being incredibly self-critical and very mm-hmm. judgmental, which in some cases has been a benefit because I've worked really hard at things, and in other cases it's been something that's held me back.
Yeah.
But talking about early life and therapy and where that stuff comes from,
yeah.
Were you always a kid that was pretty serious or hard on yourself? Or
I think that you know, I was always a very, I've always been a very introspective person. And yeah, I think, I feel like something that I can remember from being a child and being in high school and stuff was like, no, really, really, where do you stand against other people? Like wanting to be super honest with myself about exactly how smart I was, how talented I was.
You wanted to measure yourself.
Yes, but I did not want to inflate myself. I wanted to be, I wanted to have a true understanding of what I was in relationship to others and how I could work, you know, on myself to be better, to be smarter, to be more talented, you know, like, and I don't know where that came from. It was very self-driven, you know.
When did you discover you liked performing? Because I think for someone who wants to look that hard at themselves, mm-hmm. you pick sort of a hard road for that, right?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, my father was an actor when I was growing up. He was mostly a theater actor.
Like in New York on stage?
Mm-hmm. And regionally. And so I spent some time in the theater. He switched careers in his late 40s. So he had a bunch of different careers. But for the first part of my childhood, he was in the theater a lot. And so I spent a lot of time in theaters and watching him on stage. And
I think that's such a beautiful way to be introduced to your profession.
Yeah.
That your dad did it.
And I have a couple of early memories of like seeing him on a stage and being like, is that my father? Is that this character? And, you know, kind of trying to sort out what was going on.
Yeah.
And realizing that it was both. He was both my father and this other person. And being kind of really excited at that duality, I guess. And I remember he was doing a play called The Dining Room. And I went and stayed with him for a week. He was doing it somewhere in North Carolina. And I saw every performance for a week. And by the end of that week, I knew every single word in that play.
Not just his parts,
no,
but
no,
the
no.
whole
the
thing.
Whole, I knew the whole thing. There was another kid there, the son of one of the actresses in the play. And we performed the entire play.
Really?
For our parents because, you know, you're just such a sponge when you're like 8
yeah.
years old. So
was that something where you're like, I want to do this? Like,
yeah.
Did it come naturally to you? And
I think I knew that I was some kind of performer, but I wasn't a really extroverted person at school. So the first thing that I really enjoyed was singing, and then and I did like, you know, musicals through grade school and stuff, and I hated the acting part, but I loved the singing part.
That's funny to hear you say that, because I would, you know, I would think of you as such a lover of pure, like, theatrical, you know, Ibsen and
I mean, I am, you know, I have arrived there, I guess, but no,
what was
I
the
still,
musical that did it for you as a kid? Was it Annie?
Yeah, I was an Annie.
Were you?
I was.
Were you Annie?
No, I wasn't Annie. I was, like, the bully. I was Pepper.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think that was the first musical I was ever in, but yeah, there's something about singing. I think the thing that I liked about it was, again, that kind of like the structure, you know, like standing in one place and expressing yourself through song, you
right.
know, and it's the melody and the rhythm are circumscribed, and it's just about letting it pour forth. It felt really good. It felt really right, you know, and then as I got older, that became a more nuanced proposal for me, I guess,
yeah.
through sort of language and character and storytelling and the body and moving the body and stuff like that. But
well, when did you say, okay, I'm actually going to pursue this for real?
It's, you know, it's all so like murky because I think from the time I was like that 8-year-old, I carried it with me. Like I sort of knew on some level I was going to do it. But I came from a sort of more academic family. Like, my father was also an English literature professor, and my mother was a writer, and my education was really important to me. So I pursued my education. I went to a Bronx Science, which is a math and science magnet school in New York City, and then I went to Bryn Mawr, which is a small liberal arts women's
yeah.
college outside of Philly. I think I thought, well, when I'm, you know, when I get out of college, I'll do this. I'll pursue acting. I mean, that was sort of always the plan, I guess. But I was not super focused on it. I was really focused on my education, and I just kind of had a feeling that I would, I don't know,
it's
arrive
so funny.
There.
It's so funny because I know I felt at that age that you're too late
mm-hmm.
if you...
Start that late.
Yeah, and if you pursue something else for that long.
Well, that wasn't the message I was given. You know, like, the message I was given was, like, you get an education. That's just what you do.
They didn't want you, like, getting in a situation where you didn't have anything to fall back on.
And they had both been actors. My parents met when my mother was also an actor in New York, but by the time I was growing up, she had stopped. So they weren't, like, ever telling me what to do or how to do it. But I don't think they were super keen on me being an actor.
Did you ever get any sense that they weren't totally encouraging you, but they weren't discouraging you, or?
Well, I mean, it was complicated. I mean, I think particularly my father has always taken a real vicarious pleasure in my being an actor. And, you know, he still very much loves the craft, and as does my mother, you know, like, still to this day, whenever I do something, they're the people whose opinions I actually kind of trust the most.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I trust them to tell me when they believe something is good, when they've really been interested in taken with a performance. Like, that still probably matters more to me than anybody else's opinion. So I allowed myself to be kind of led by them, and they really encouraged me to sort of go to the math and science high school, pursue my college education, you know, like, and I don't think I was prepared at all psychically or emotionally to sort of graduate from high school and do
run off
what?
To LA and
run
audition
off to like I never thought I would be in LA. Like, I just never saw myself there. And so even when I graduated from college, there was this terrific moment where I was like, well, okay, now what do I do?
You could almost get the sense from all of the press or whatever that you've done that your life kind of started at Mad Men.
Which I find really funny because, you know, I was in my early 30s when Mad Men happened. So there was, 10 or 15 years of hard work.
It doesn't sound like you were as laser focused on becoming famous or becoming a movie star or becoming a television star, which probably makes you different than most actors.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I wasn't. I wanted to be a professional actor. I wanted to be a theater actor. I wanted to be a great actor, but I had no aspirations for stardom. I could not imagine, like, I remember there was a director I worked with in my early 20s who was like, you should go out to L.A. And I was like, phew.
Didn't even see that at all.
I was like, how could I possibly do that? Like, it just seemed impossible. I don't even know why. It just felt like I would have no idea where to start. I would have no clue. You know, every piece for me of becoming a more commercial actor or, you know, was difficult and kind of painful. Like, I remember, like, meeting with some agents in New York who had seen me in something in Philadelphia in my early 20s, and they were like, lose 10 pounds and tweeze your eyebrows. And I was like, what? Like, it was just awful. Like, it was so dispiriting and made me feel like really gross on the inside, you know?
Like that you would want something monetarily or something that changed you.
It felt like somebody was asking me to be something other than what I was, and that felt really upsetting to me. And the thought of, like, well, making a bargain, like, well, if I did this, maybe I would then get cast. It made me very uncomfortable. And so the thing that kind of I think changed my prospects for having a more commercial career was I'd been doing a lot of stage work in Philadelphia, and I felt the lack of training. Like, I was doing some plays, and I was really insecure, and I felt like I needed to strengthen myself or fortify myself. I felt like I was failing or falling short for myself.
Really?
And I felt like I needed some help. So I went and sought out some great teachers. I started taking class in New York, and I found a great teacher. His name is Ron Van Loo, who he runs Yale now, but he was the head teacher at NYU at the time. And I was like, I'm gonna follow this guy. And so I applied to graduate school kind of late. I was like 27 when I went into school, and I graduated when I was 30.
I wonder where that critical voice and the insecurity came from.
I don't know. It's just always been with me.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's part of what I was talking about earlier, the sort of like wanting to really be honest with myself about what my strengths and weaknesses were and how I could be better. And, you know, I think in some ways I felt like if I kept looking and challenging myself, that I would make myself better. You know, but nobody taught me how to self-inflate the way some people are so good at it.
Right. Well, I would think at some point that would become very hard for an actor to, because that sounds like the opposite of being in the present.
Well, I will say, I think the thing that graduate school taught me more than it taught me how to act, I think I knew how to act. You know, like, it taught me how to deal with criticism, other people's and my own, and it fortified me, you know, like it made me understand that the craft is just the pursuit and the process, and it made me kinder and gentler on myself. And, you know, as long as I stay focused on process, then I love what I do, and I don't get bogged down in, you know, tremendous insecurity. Like, I don't struggle with that anymore in the same way.
The hardest thing about your 20s was struggling with the insecurity and that taking the joy out of,
yeah.
Right? Especially if you're doing something that has so much rejection built into the process of just being able to work.
Yeah.
That brings up the whole auditioning process. Tell me about when you sort of made that leap and started doing television and looking for roles and film roles and how it led to Mad Men.
Well, I mean, auditioning is so, God, it's so awful. It's really awful.
Really?
I hate it.
It's not your thing.
No, it's not my thing. I mean, I actually think I used to be better at it when I was auditioning more. Like, before I was anybody, you know, you just audition for everything. And
right.
So you build, it's a muscle. You know, it really is a muscle like anything else. It's like you just, the more you do it, the better you are at it, the more facile you are, the more quickly you can learn the material, and
right.
The better you are at walking into a room and going and playing, because, you know, it becomes its own process that you get to sort of like think about and pick apart. Okay, I have another one tomorrow, and you know.
And if this one didn't go well, I have another one tomorrow, and it's fine. And
yeah, so, you know, at the time that I was auditioning for Mad Men, I was auditioning a lot. You know, the first year or two that I was out of graduate school, I think I auditioned for about 9 months before I like landed anything really,
oh, really?
Significant. But those 9 months of being rejected were incredibly productive because I made a lot of fans. And, you know, it's like I was doing well in auditions.
Right.
I just wasn't getting jobs. And I was totally able to live with that. You know, I think that's one of the things that my training prepared me for, was like
living with the rejection. Or
yeah.
The, yeah.
You know, rolling with it and not giving up, you know, and then I did a bunch of theater, and then the next year, I think I'd been out of school for 2 years when Mad Men kind of happened.
I read that you saw the role and you really wanted it, and you decided to really go after it. And the first thing I thought when I saw that was, how do you really try hard at something? Like, how do you try harder at one audition than the other?
Well, I have always found that it's only when I really want something and when I really love something, those are the only ones I get. I'm trying to think if that's actually... No, that's pretty true. That's pretty accurate. There are things that I am offered that I do that I may feel like a little less sure, you know, passionate about. But
right.
In terms of, and especially at that time in my life, like, it's only the roles that I'm like, or projects that I'm like really excited about and I have to audition for, those are the ones that you tend to nail, you know, the ones that find you. But the full story of that audition, actually, is that I was supposed to read for the role of Peggy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And my manager called me that morning and said, you know what? I think you're Rachel. I don't think you're Peggy. And I was like, I think you're right.
Now, let's stop for a minute and go. But Peggy was on 7 seasons.
Well, that's true. But, you know, nobody knew.
Nobody knew anything, right? Nobody knew Mad Men would go more than one season.
Yeah. I mean, Mad Men was an art project, you know, like.
Right, right.
It was an art project for AMC. And I read that script and I was like, this is amazing. Like, it was brilliant on the page. And also, when you read a pilot script, you're really just thinking about a pilot. You know, like, you never know if it's going to go beyond that. And then if it does, what its life is, what the life of that character is. So so I just had the morning to prepare for Rachel.
So you couldn't stew over it?
No, I couldn't stew, which is good. So I just prepared it and I went in, and then they kept calling me back. And that was where I think, like, there was some psychological fortitude involved, because they called me back, I don't know, maybe 4 times.
Right.
And, you know, every time they called me back, I was just, for some reason, and it just doesn't happen very much, I just knew that the character belonged to me.
Really?
I was like, she's mine. Like, no, I was like, I don't think anybody else can do this character. It's such a rare feeling. Like, I mean, it really almost never, ever happens. But, you know, like, the third time they called me back, my manager was like, well, this is never good. He was like, you know, they keep calling you back. It's not good. It's like, you know, he was like, this is the moment when they bring somebody else in who runs away with the role. And I was like, no. I'm going to get
this. Yeah, because you figure if they're calling you back, there might be some dissension between filmmaker and network.
Right, exactly.
Did it feel like a big deal at the time, or did it just feel like, great, I'm doing this pilot and it's an interesting project?
More like that.
Because you moved to L.A. for it, right?
Yeah, well, we shot the pilot, and then there was a long wait. I can't remember how long we waited until it got picked up, but then we didn't start shooting a series until almost a year and a half after we shot the pilot.
Wow.
So there was a long sort of wait in between.
And then you call your parents and you say, I'm moving to Los Angeles.
No, I'm going to Los Angeles for 6 months. You'll see me in 6 months when this art project is done.
Right.
And then I'll come back to New York and resume my my theater activities.
There's a youngest child mindset that you're always really the baby and you belong to your parents, right?
Mm-hmm. I think actually moving to L.A., like, there was a lot that was going on in my life at the time that was very, there was a lot of rupture in my life. So, like, I was ending a relationship, a really long relationship, right when I came out here to do Mad Men. And
that's a good thing, right? You change careers, you change boyfriends.
It was a whole, like, it really was like my life kind of split in half. And I got out here, and I really loved it, and I really needed the change. And I liked L.A. a lot. I had no idea that I would. And I was also like, I can't go back there. I just couldn't go back there for emotional, personal reasons. I just felt like I couldn't go back to the East Coast. So
did you find something in TV acting or in acting in front of a camera that actually suited you even more?
I don't know if it suits me more. It suits me differently. I mean, sometimes I think, sometimes to me it feels like people's careers, you know, especially as an actor, like you, I really like to believe that I have choice, and I do say no to a lot of things, and, you know, but there is a way that your career kind of finds you. Sometimes it feels that way, because it's like I was saying, it's some weird thing that happens in the ether where something really appeals to you so much that you go for something. Something finds you, something sticks to you, which then attracts the next thing, which sticks to you, you know, and so there's this, like, you meet your career halfway.
Right.
But you're not fully deciding what your career is, I don't think. I mean, at least that's been my experience.
Yeah.
I feel like I would never have anticipated this being where I was in my early 40s. You know, like, ask me 20 years ago where I was going to be, and I would never in a million years have said, here, doing this. One of the things that I've really loved about the way my career shift changed gears, because working in the theater all the time versus working in film and television, and in particular the way and the projects that I've been involved with, I don't know how to describe it. When you're a theater actor and you're on stage, you feel like the entire responsibility of whether or not something is working is on your shoulders, because you're literally doing the work every night.
Right, you know? Right.
Whereas on camera and in somebody's film or on a TV show, like, you're just a piece, you know, you're edited, you're put together, you're part of a larger tapestry. Like, so the way people talk about me or my work, it doesn't, I feel a lot more distance from it, you know, like.
Oh, that's interesting. It's almost the opposite.
It's almost the opposite. Like,
yeah.
I feel, you know, I still feel pressure, obviously, but it's a more pure pressure in terms of the pressure I put on myself to do my best.
Right.
As opposed to, like, delivering the project. Like, it's really, it feels so much of it feels out of my hands. And there's something about that I actually like. I like being able to just focus on doing the best that I can, sending it out there and letting somebody else sort of put it together.
Well, also you're in a position now where you've worked so steadily for so long. I mean, that's the crazy thing about signing a TV contract is that you have no idea. I mean, what, 6 years on Sons of Anarchy?
Yeah, and I didn't expect that to happen either.
How could you? I mean,
right.
And yet I can understand a comment of, it's sort of out of my hands after that, because whether that show gets picked up or not has nothing to do with you, except tangentially as part of a cast and however they market it. But at the same time, I would think that would play upon your idea of success just by human nature of, you know, I'm working so long, I actually need a break. Like, there's probably a mind shift of how you look at success. You probably don't worry about it as much as you used to because you haven't had time to worry about it.
I mean, at the end of Sons of Anarchy, I was pregnant and I had a baby. And, you know, I wanted to take a year off just to have a year off and have my baby and, you know, not have to be interfered with in that process. And that was a really interesting moment because something about being a mom and the incredible, like, psychic shift that comes along with that and that job having just ended, I was like, I don't know if I can imagine acting again, much less where the next job is coming from. Like,
really?
It felt so far away. Yeah, because it was such a radical change to have a baby and be a parent, and I was really into it. And, you know, the thought of pretending to be somebody else rather than this person's mother, you know, was like, I just couldn't wrap my mind around it. And so I had a really beautiful kind of reprieve in a way, because I knew that I was taking that time off and I didn't obsess about the next job because I didn't want a job and I couldn't imagine working again. And I had just come off of a long job and had a cushion, and so that transition was very odd. And then, you know, and then I started reading scripts, and then I read Billions, and then I was like, yeah, I want that job. You know, I felt the energy come back to me for it, and I put myself on tape for it.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I had to audition for it.
Would you rather audition live in a room or on tape?
I actually prefer auditioning on, well, it sort of depends on what it is. For a theater project, always in a room with the people. For, I actually like putting myself on tape.
You do?
I do. Because, you know, if you're a
Structure, process,
perfectionism, you do it over and over. You know, there's a lot going for it. In the privacy of your own home where you can, like, not have to deal with the jitters and the nonsense of walking into a room and how a casting director is or isn't treating you or,
do you obsess over, though? Do you watch the take and then go back and over and over?
Yeah, I watch the takes and
you go in a room and 3 days later you come out.
No, not that long. I mean, you know, one of the nice things about having a kid is there's, like, time constraints on everything now, so.
Isn't that funny how it focuses your time?
It does.
But I have to ask you about Sons of Anarchy, because it's a show that snuck up on me. As a photographer, I had a bunch of really burly tattooed assistants, and I think they all watched that show. And right there, I was like, I'm not watching that, you know? But I watched it, and I sort of got hooked, and I realized I was watching something akin to a Shakespeare tragedy or some sort of larger-than-life Sopranos type thing. And but I think what really kept me watching and drew me in was your character, because you grounded that series in a lot of ways. Like, you were the normal person that I would have been if I happened to be in that town. And, and it really grew on me. And as the series goes along and people get killed and people get killed, and in my head, I'm like, well, they're never going to kill Tara because she's going to be the redemption. That's how this story's going. She's going to redeem this man. Right. I mean, that's, I think, why you stick with that show, is because somewhere inside of the character played by Charlie Hunnam, Jax, there's redemption, and she's his savior.
And redemption, right.
And then they kill you. And I just, I watched that episode thinking that had to be one of the hardest weeks an actor could possibly have. You have to deal with scenes where you're betrayed by someone you love, you lose your power, you have to go through an action-packed death scene. I mean, was that the hardest thing you've ever done as an actor?
Probably, yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I think that week was really, really challenging. Like, the thing you leave out of that equation is also the, like, days you have to keep shooting where you're a dead body on the floor covered in blood.
Exactly. No, I have, I want to know about that, too, because
After you've been
killed. After you're finished, you're not finished.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that show is so, it's so operatic that there's always sort of a pleasure in fulfilling the, you know, the intensity or the size or the scale of that piece of storytelling. So it was, you know, it was also an exciting week, but it was hard and it was sad. You know, it's like they don't teach you in acting school how to, like, say goodbye to characters, you know, like there's this weird
there should be a class.
And I know Ryan
when
Hurst,
you get killed off.
When you get killed off, here's how you mourn. Like Ryan Hurst, who played Opie, when he got killed off of that show, I think it was also really, really hard for him to, like, let the character go. And he's talked about it a bunch, but, you know, the like, I love Charlie and Katie, and, like, you play a family, and, you know, for that long, and, like, you know, like, I have this amazing heart connection with those people. And so, you know, like, it was hard shooting the scene where Katie kills me and all of that, but it was really hard for Katie to kill me. And then it was hard being dead on the floor because it was cold and uncomfortable and really weird, but it was really hard for me to lie there and watch Charlie or Jax find Tara. You know, like, in some ways, that's, like, the hardest part of it, was, like, watching the characters suffer, like, kind of around me.
Well, I would think, you know, going back to our therapy theme, that there has to be transference that takes place when you're on a show for that long, and your memories of the show and the experience of acting on it probably get mixed in with the memories you're supposed to have and remember as the actor, too, right? Yeah. How do you help a scene partner when you're playing dead? Like, what are you doing when they call cut and he's holding you and he's crying and then it's cut? How do you help your scene partner in death?
You pat him on the knee. He's just like, it's okay, Charlie, I'm right here. I don't know. I mean,
it was surreal, right?
Yeah. But yeah, the hardest part is just that you're attached to your fellow actors who are also these characters. And yes, like you're saying, there is this kind of conflation of the fictional and the personal, and it feels very, very personal.
Well, and also the women on that show are powerful. Yeah. And you know, to have a role that long. There's a film you've done, I don't think it's come out yet, called A Woman Apart, which I saw, and I think it's fascinating.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah, and just quickly, you play a television actress who's committed to a series for 6 years.
Yes.
And unlike real life, you don't want to be committed to this thing, and you've become ambivalent about the role, and you're on some prescription drugs, and the film takes place with you having a crisis of confidence about your own career, and you have to, you know, you have to sort of figure this out. And so you go off to New York and you visit your old theater troupe. Mm-hmm. And as much as I'm sure you're not like your character,
right,
there are certainly parallels that line up with your life. And you know, thinking about that experience of being on a television show for 6 years on Sons of Anarchy, mm-hmm, and then getting a script like that, I just wonder if an experience like that makes you, and also, you know, ending Sons of Anarchy, if it makes you step back and look at your career or your profession, mm-hmm, more analytically.
I mean, when I read the script, and you know, I was really scared of it because I was like, I've never really played a part that's that close to me, even though I'm not that character. There are things about her life and her struggle that I deeply identified with. And then I was like, well, I'll never get a chance to play a character who has so many things in common with me. As scary as that is, I should probably just do it and,
yeah,
you know, see what that's like and explore.
What scared you about it, about doing that? I would think part of it would be like, I got this, I know how to do this.
I think maybe part of it was just maybe a little worried that I would be mistaken for the character, that people would think it was a story about me in some ways, which it's not.
Right.
And there's something a little, I didn't want it to feel, I don't know, I didn't want it to feel like a self-serious actor doing a psychodrama about being an actor. I wanted it to be an interesting story, you know, I didn't want it to feel navel-gazy.
And you didn't want it to be messagey before, over story, right?
Right, yes, that's right.
Because I think there's, I mean, let's be honest, there's strong themes about feminism and the way women are treated.
There are.
And not even treated, but the opportunities and roles available to women, that those issues come up in that,
yeah,
film.
And I wanted to make sure that I felt, you know, I feel enough in line with the director's thinking about all of those things, the writer's thinking about all of those things, that I wanted to tell the story and tell it in that way.
So you got to be a part of developing the,
yeah,
role.
I'm a producer on the film. And yeah. Yeah, because she strangely, randomly had me in mind for it. You know, she'd been sort of thinking about who could play the part, and then she met me randomly at a yoga class in Los Angeles.
Oh, really?
Elizabeth Subrin, and she was like, can I give you this script? And she told me what it was about, and she's a really, really interesting visual artist, but this is her first narrative feature.
Well, tell me her name, Elizabeth Subrin?
Elizabeth Subrin.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, this was her first sort of narrative feature-length film. But she's a very interesting artist, and she,
yeah,
considers herself a feminist filmmaker. And I cared about telling that story, and I wanted to be a part of it.
Was part of the process sort of having to look at why you are an actress?
I think part of the process was sort of thinking about the moments when I've come the closest to having like severe crises or, you know, questions of doubt. And you know, like when did those things happen for me and why, and sort of talking to her and sort of delving into the specifics of how that kind of nervous breakdown could happen to somebody living this life and doing,
right,
this kind of work and why.
What came up for you?
You know, we were talking about my 20s and my life in Philadelphia, right? Like,
yeah,
in some ways that for me is the road not taken, like, you know, like, I think a lot about, well, what would it be like if I was still living in like a place like that, and, you know, say I had started to make my own work or teach or, you know,
done a one-woman show or,
yeah, I mean, all of which is still like possible, conceivable, and everything else, but a different kind of life, a life more based in community, not based in sort of commercial entertainment or any kind of celebrity or, you know, like...
No eyebrow tweezing.
Exactly. Like, what does that life look like versus this life?
And that brings up your authentic, pure critic.
My purest,
yeah,
yes, my purest internal critic versus,
it's fascinating.
You know,
yeah, because she got the right actors for that, because it sounds like those are things that was a real crossroads for you.
Yeah, and those are things that I always think about. You know, I always think about, like, you know, authenticity. And she found a group of actors who absolutely connect to that struggle of, you know, what it means to sort of... There's just this spectrum, right, when you're an actor of, like, art and art making versus like pure commerce and pure entertainment, and like where you fall on that spectrum, and how you make your choices so that you can like pay back your student loans and like make a living,
right,
versus like how to satisfy yourself creatively. The thing that's nice about having a measure of success or having some financial freedom or whatever is that the things that I think about now have a lot less to do with like advancing my career, which sure, like I could advance my career more, right? But they're much more to do with like how do I satisfy myself in my deepest down place? Like what can I do to make myself feel like a wholly challenged, creatively satisfied human? And that, you know, when I think about what that is, it probably means doing a play in the next year, or you know, like doing something that isn't commercial. And those to me are the most like the sort of like independent film where people are just doing it for the love of it, and theater, and where people are just doing it for the love of it. Like that's actually where the greatest satisfaction comes from often.
Hearing you talk about this, it makes total sense to me that the film translated so well to me, because you were the right actor to play that role, you know? There's a scene where you're throwing scripts and pages of scripts into a swimming pool. Mm-hmm. And it's almost, I think, the most metaphorical point in the film, because it's a comment on how many crappy throwaway roles probably everyone who makes that crossover to commercial work gets offered, right? I mean, was there a certain inside knowledge of that scene?
Well, one conversation was, I was like, I don't read scripts on paper anymore. She's like, I know, but we need the swimming pool scene.
But we can't throw the computers into the pool.
We don't have the budget. Well, yeah, I mean, there was definitely. I mean, you know, and particularly for us ladies, like there's a lot of that. What that scene captures is like, oh, and now you're playing the bitter divorced wife, and now you're playing the bitchy best friend, and now you're like all these things that as an actress you're like, oh God, oh, please no, and that rings true.
I think the film does such a good job of portraying the struggle of being an artist. Because, look, everybody in that situation, they're going to go after that. You know what I mean? Like, I think most people in this world, if they're being honest with themselves, they're going to end up in L.A. on the television show, and they're not going to know until they're there that it isn't fulfilling.
Right.
Because it seems like the next step and the next step.
Right.
And you know, talking to you, I just feel like, you know, whatever you struggle with your critical voice or insecurity, I think that you come from this place of wanting to have an artistic life and have a life that has purity in it. And I'm right there. That's pretty amazing. Like, it really is. Like, talking to you and hearing how adamant you were about trying to be pure, even at a young age, with your work, it's refreshing.
Oh.
You don't hear that often.
You
know? And then you're doing this great work.
Oh.
And if we can just get you with Seth Rogen, you know, locked outside of a house in the snow,
the picture will be complete.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I kind of wish, I think it would have been really great for me to be an actor in the 40s, like screwball comedies, you know?
You think so? A little Bringing Up Baby? Or...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah?
I think somebody needs to put me in a screwball comedy.
I think so.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me. What a pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope you got some free therapy out of it. If you're not totally familiar with Maggie's work, go check out Billions, and then go watch Sons of Anarchy. And seek out A Woman Apart. It's an interesting independent film that will give you a whole new perspective on women in the film industry. And when you're done seeking that out, seek out offcamera.com. Did you know that we have a store? And in that store, you can get really cool things like the off-camera magazine and off-camera t-shirts? Well, it's true. We make a magazine for every single person that appears on the show. And it's a great way to spice up your coffee table and to get way more in depth with the artists that come on the show. So check that out. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Off Camera Show at both Twitter and Instagram.
And you can follow me at Sam Jones at Twitter and at Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. Also, if you haven't yet subscribed to this podcast, take a minute and do so. And while you're at it, leave us a rating. Anything above 4 stars is acceptable. But subscribing is a great way to make sure you don't miss a single episode of the show. And most importantly, you have to join us next week when I sit down with actor, director, and man of 1,000 voices, Hank Azaria.
I became an actor because I wanted to not be myself. Being a mimic, I'm basically copying everything from, you know, Peter Sellers to Steve Martin to De Niro to Pacino. I didn't know where I fit into all that. It was the belief that it's boring. You don't want to see me. I mean, what's interesting is how Woody Allen would react to something, not how Hank Azaria would. Like, who cares about that?
You might know him as Chief Wiggum or Apu or Moe the Bartender, or any of the dozen other iconic Simpsons characters that we've grown to know and love over the years. He talks with me about his uncanny abilities as a mimic and how they helped and sometimes held him back as an artist. In addition to going deep into the Simpsons, we talk about how fatherhood changed his life and how difficult it can be to let go of what others think. We also go inside baseball and learn how he makes us love Jim Brockmeyer, one of the most deplorable announcers to ever call a game. See you next time, off camera.